Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
It is my intention to finish the book of Habakkuk this evening. I do believe that we can do that, because at the end of last week, we skipped forward to the end of the book in order to establish the larger theme of the whole book, which I'll get to in a second. What we know so far is that the book of Habakkuk is a theodicy. It is an explanation, an apologetic for God being a very holy God, and yet there is wickedness in his creation, and yet he retains his absolute spotless holiness despite the wickedness that does exist. And so Habakkuk pointed out to God that everywhere he looked in Israel, he saw nothing but wickedness, and he wanted God to move, to do something. God's response was that he was going to bring an even more wicked nation, which we know to be Babylon. He even names the Chaldeans. He's going to bring them down on Israel in order to punish Israel for their wickedness, which is enough to make Habakkuk completely confused, because he doesn't understand how God can punish wickedness with greater wickedness. And the end of it is God explaining he is always, as the holy, righteous God, he is always going to punish wickedness. He is always, as a righteous God, going to do what is ultimately righteous. Our job is to trust him and have faith that he knows what he is doing, even during circumstances that are beyond our comprehension. That is the basic theme of the book of Habakkuk. Let's see, chapter 2, starting around verse 2, the Lord answered Habakkuk and told him, record this vision that he's about to give him, inscribe it on tablets, so that the one who reads it may run, not running away for fear, but run to tell it, to go proclaim this. A very important concept here, for the vision is yet for the appointed time, and it hastens toward the goal and will not fail, and though it waits, though it tarries, you wait for it, for it will certainly come and it will not delay. That concept is picked up at the very end of the book, starting in chapter 3, verse 16. Habakkuk, as he's coming to his conclusion about waiting faithfully for God, says, I heard, and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones. In other words, time went by. I got older. I'm decaying. Decay is in my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. And so God has said, this is a definite thing. It is going to happen. I am going to bring it about. I know you're concerned about the wickedness of Jerusalem, the wickedness of Judah. I am definitely going to bring punishment on them. I am going to use even more wicked people to come and destroy them because of their wickedness. And then Habakkuk says, I have to wait for it, because God said wait for it. It's a definite. It has a particular time when it is going to happen. My job is to trust God, have faith in God, and just wait for it. And despite the circumstances that are going to come about, despite things like, though the fig tree should not blossom and there be no fruit, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord Yahweh. I will rejoice in Elohim, the God of my salvation, and the Lord God, Adonai Yahweh, is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and made me to walk on high places. So that is the general theme and purpose of the book, is to say that God, number one, is sovereign. He's going to do what he is going to do, and he may do it in mysterious ways that we don't always understand. Our job is, no matter how bad the circumstances get, to continue to exalt Yahweh, to continue to worship him, and to have faith in him that he does know what he's doing, and it is ultimately going to redound to his glory and ultimately to our good. And our job is just to wait and let him do it. In fact, tonight we're even going to see where God is going to say, when he is in his holy temple doing the things that seem right to him, that all the earth just has to remain silent. You don't get a say in it because he is, after all, the sovereign God. So last week we ended at, in verse 4, God had said, behold, the puffed up or the proud one, his desires, his soul is not right within him. And then contrasted that with, but the righteous will live by his faith. So he contrasted the righteous with the proud, with the arrogant. The arrogant man, through the balance of this chapter, is the king of Babylon, or the succession of kings in Babylon. And you're going to see that as the language evolves through the chapter. But he is saying that Babylon, the Chaldeans, these wicked people, are going to ultimately fall. They are ultimately going to be destroyed, and it is God who is going to destroy them. But along the way, Habakkuk engages in some very poetic, very descriptive language, and even some philosophy, some really interesting philosophy. For instance, he's going to ask, why do people labor so hard over things that are just going to burn? What a great philosophical question. Why do people put so much effort into things that result in futility? And starting in verse 5, which is where we're going to pick up tonight of chapter 2, that is the beginning of God speaking this taunt. In fact, in verse 6, it's going to be referred to as a taunt song. It is a dirge that God is stating against Babylon and then saying that the nations that Babylon conquered, when they see Babylon fall, they're going to take up this same taunt against Babylon. So starting in verse 5, furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man. That is a familiar phrase. It comes up a lot in the Proverbs, this idea that drunkenness leads to bad decisions. Furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. In other words, he doesn't just stay in Babylon. He goes out and conquers all these other nations because he's never happy. By the way, that is also the way that haughty drunks are. If they would just stay at home, we'd all be better off. But no, they want to go out. It's a reality that haughty drunks won't stay at home. But he, the king of Babylon, or the succession of kings in Babylon, he enlarges his appetite like the grave, like Sheol. And I like this phrase, and he is like death. He's never satisfied because everybody dies. What God is saying here is there is no point at which death says, okay, that's enough. I've killed enough people. Enough people have died. I'm good now. Instead, like death, like the grave, the haughty man wants more and more and more. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and he is like death. He's never satisfied. And he also gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. Will not all of those peoples, all of those nations, will not all of these take up a taunt song against him, even mockery and insinuations against him, and say, woe to him who increases what is not his? That is the first of five woes that we're going to see in this chapter. Five very distinct times that God says people are going to say, woe to Babylon as it is being destroyed. But woe to him who increases what is not his. How is the king of Babylon increasing what is not his? By conquering nations, conquering people, taking over their cities, taking over their regions, taking their riches, taking their gold. And yet that stuff is not his. For how long? And he makes himself rich with loans. In other words, he had made a lot of agreements with other nations, partnerships with other nations, and became rich through trade with the other nations. But then what if those people who are creditors to him, what if they turn on him? Verse 7, will not your creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from you awaken? Indeed, you will become plunder for them. By the way, that's what happened when the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon. They were servant to Babylon until the day that they decided that they had had enough and went and conquered Babylon. Because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of your peoples will loot you. Because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land and to the town and to all of its inhabitants. That language of the land is going to come up again, because all of the land belongs to God. And he's going to point out that in their zeal to build, they cut down so many trees in Lebanon that they did violence to the land and to the animals of the land. And God is going to hold them guilty over that as well. So it is much more than just you treated people badly. You treated my land badly. You treated animals badly. God sees several different levels of responsibility here as he is pouring out his judgment on Babylon. You've looted many nations, and so the remainder of the peoples will loot you because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and to all its inhabitants. Woe. There's the second woe. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, the one who has unjust scales, the one who's willing to kill, to go destroy other people just to get their possessions and their gold. He does evil in order to get riches for his house, but it is evil gain. For what reason? To build himself a nest up on high, to build himself a palace, to build him a fortress that he thinks is going to protect him so that he can't be touched by the normal calamities that affect everybody else. To put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. You have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off many people. So you are sinning against yourself. So God tells the king of Babylon that he is responsible for the fact that he is ultimately going to be destroyed, and that the sin he is sinning is not just a sin against God, it is a sin against himself, because he is guaranteeing his own destruction in the way he is destroying people and land and animals just to get riches for himself, just to build himself greater edifices to himself. So you are sinning against yourself. Surely the stone will cry out from the wall, the fortress that you've built, And the rafter that holds up the ceiling, the rafter will answer it from the framework of the house. In other words, the stone and the timber of your house knows that it is the result of the bloodshed and the conquering of people and land and trees and animals. And so this taunt against you is going to be joined even by the things that you've built. This is a complete denunciation of the king of Babylon, if even the things he builds are a testament against him. Woe to him, verse 12, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Is it not indeed from Yahweh of armies that people toil for fire? In other words, they work so hard to build things. They work so hard to construct these edifices for themselves. And yet when God's punishment comes, when God's destruction comes, all the stuff that they have built for themselves is going to burn. Ultimately, according to Peter, everything on this planet is going to burn. It is in the intention of God that he is going to come and destroy these things that people have built. So it is indeed from Yahweh of armies that people toil for fire. And nations will weary themselves. They will work so hard to conquer other nations. They will work so hard to become the most powerful of nations. But ultimately, that's going to come to nothing, because all of the great nations, all the great kingdoms in history have all eventually disappeared. They have all been destroyed. They have all been conquered by other people groups. That is the way of the world. And so all of their building, all of their toil, all of their bloodshed, all of their destruction ultimately comes to nothing. And then as the kingdoms of the world are gradually becoming nothing despite all their toil, despite all the bloodshed, despite all the violence, nevertheless, look at verse 14, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. So the contrast is huge. The nations of this world, the kingdoms of this world, are ultimately going to come to nothing. But Yahweh himself continues through it all, and one day the knowledge of Yahweh, the understanding of Yahweh, will cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. Now that is a theme that actually several of the prophets do pick up. In fact, it starts all the way back in Numbers, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, fourth book of the Bible, we read, so the Lord said. He's speaking to Moses here, I have pardoned them according to your word, but indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of Yahweh. All the way back when talking to Israel during their establishment through Moses, the declaration has already occurred. Now, you may remember the blueprint. God has already said that Israel is going to enter the land, that Israel's going to rebel, that they're going to be driven out of their land, they're going to be scattered, they're going to be regathered, they're going to come back. He told them all of that before he even took them into the promised land. But he also told them that one day, the entire earth will be filled with the glory of Yahweh. That is the ultimate end of God's entire intention for all of human history. Psalm 72, 18 and 19 picks up that same idea. Blessed is the Lord God, the God of Israel, who alone works wonders, and blessed be his glorious name forever. And may the whole earth be filled with his glory. Amen and amen. Where did the writer of the Psalms get that idea? From the fact that God had already declared it back in Numbers. Isaiah picks it up in one of the most famous passages of Isaiah. Most of you know these words. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on the throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." Far too often people stop right there. The rest of what they said is, "And the whole earth is full of his glory." So this theme of the glory of the Lord covering the earth is consistent in the prophetic passages of the Old Testament. So then when is that going to happen? So far, we haven't seen it. So far, we'd have to admit that the glory of the Lord does not cover the planet. But in Isaiah 11, this very, very messianic passage, starting at verse 1, it says, "Then a shoot will spring forth from the stem of Jesse," Jesse being David's father, so a descendant of David's, "and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eye sees, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. And the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand in the viper's den." Okay, has that happened yet? Is any of that occurring on planet Earth yet? Okay, so now we have some idea when it's going to happen. It is tied together with the coming of the seed of Jesse, with Christ, because verse 9 of the passage in Isaiah 11 says, "And they will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the water covers the sea." Same language that Habakkuk picked up. Habakkuk being familiar with Isaiah and also saying, this is still a good promise. This is still going to happen. The righteousness of God is going to spread out on the planet, despite the fact that right now God's people are wicked. Right now God's people are rebellious. And God is going to bring an even more wicked nation down on them. And so it is just wickedness everywhere you can look. But in the divine plan of God, who is holy and righteous, he is ultimately going to bring about the divine finality of it all. It's all going to wrap up in Christ, the all and in all. He is going to bring about this millennium, this time of peace on earth, when David's greater son is going to rule in Jerusalem. And during that time, the knowledge of the Lord is going to cover the earth. So if you don't see Jesus on a throne in Jerusalem right now, that's why you don't see the knowledge of God covering the earth yet. But it is going to happen. The prophets keep bringing that idea up. So Habakkuk says, actually God speaking and Habakkuk recording it, "For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Now, speaking again to the king of Babylon, "Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk so as to look on their nakedness." Chances are, this is a sexual reference to talk about the depravity of the Babylonians, but it was also a fairly common practice in the Middle East that when you conquered a group of people, you would put them in chains and parade them naked through the streets to shame them and to show that they had been utterly conquered. That's a possibility, but I think this is God saying that in their debauchery, they are even using poisons and they are using alcohol in order to fulfill their sexual desires. So you will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you. In other words, as they are conquering Jerusalem, they're going to say, they're going to taunt Jerusalem, they're going to taunt the Jews and say, where is your God? Because your God didn't protect you from us, the mighty Babylonians. But now God says, but that cup of the Lord's wrath that's in his right hand, it's going to find you too. Your turn is coming. And utter disgrace will come upon your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you. So now he's going to start talking about the violence that is done to trees, animals, and the land as they steamed through with their armies, as they went through their building projects, as they cut down all the trees and made the land bare and sent the animals scattering. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them. Because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all its inhabitants. And then he turns to the fact that they are idol worshipers. What profit is the idol when its maker is the one who carved it? It seems like an obvious question from God. He's like, I'm the living God, I'm the real God, I'm the creator God, and yet you're worshiping things that you made. You actually carved it. How is that profitable to you? What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it? Or an image, which is a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork, which he fashions as speechless idols. One of the things that we see in the Bible, one of the most revelatory things that we see in the Bible, is that the God of the Bible talks. He actually explains himself. He actually explains the future. He explains the past. He demonstrates his creative power. He demonstrates his sovereignty over everything and then takes the time to point it out with words. I think one of the reasons that God invented language was so that he could communicate with us. And he is a God who communicates. And so he is comparing that with the fact that the dumb idols don't ever say anything. And yet the person who makes it trusts it, even though it's his own handiwork. He's the one who made it. And he fashions for himself a speechless idol. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake. Obviously, if you are worshiping a chunk of wood that you've made into an idol, you think that it's going to have some power or ability. It's going to do something for you, some benefit you're going to gain from it. And so you're looking at a piece of wood and saying, wake up, because I made you. You're my God now. Or to a mute stone, arise. And that he, the mute stone, the piece of wood, and that he is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver. There is no breath at all inside it. But by contrast, but Yahweh is in his holy temple. In other words, you didn't make him. You didn't carve or create him. He has always been, and he is in the holy temple that only he could exist in. He is in his holy temple, and let all the earth be silent before him. The simple reality is whatever differences people may have with the God of the Bible. Ultimately, they're never going to get to make those arguments. Whatever differences, whatever ways they may want to blame the God of the Bible, they're never going to have the opportunity to hold him accountable, because he is, in the end, the holy and the righteous God who does whatever he wants to do. He is the sovereign God, and if we found out anything from the book of Job, it's that God doesn't like the question, why? Because God will answer, who are you? And where were you? And I do everything, and you don't. And your reaction ultimately, regardless of who you are, is going to be the same as Job's. You're going to say, I heard about you, but now I see you, and therefore I hate me. I abhor myself, because now I see who you are, what you are. And so the God who is in his holy temple contrasts himself with the idols who can't speak, who can't think, who can't even walk. You have to pick them up and carry them around. And the insanity of people then thinking that the thing they made is a God who is going to benefit them in some way, the depth of that insanity just shows their depravity. And yet, the God of heaven, the real God, the maker of heaven and earth, the God of Israel, isn't dismayed ultimately by any of that. He's still sitting in his temple on his throne, and nobody gets to say anything. The whole earth must remain silent when he is displaying his holiness, his righteousness, his uniqueness, his separateness, and how high he is above us. Now, chapter 3 is Habakkuk's response to all this. God has just said, okay, I'm going to use Babylon to conquer Israel, but then I am going to judge Babylon, because ultimately righteous God is going to do righteousness. The righteousness of God is going to ultimately cover the whole earth, and therefore God's righteousness is not failing. God's righteousness is going to correct all the sin of the whole world. And so now Habakkuk is going to respond to that. And his response takes the form of a genuine doxology, if you know what I mean. Doxa, the word for glory. He is actually glorifying God in the things he's saying. He's bringing himself to the reality that we read last week and that we read tonight. He's bringing himself to the point of saying, okay, this is going to be difficult, but you are God, and all I can do is wait and have faith. So this is how he gets to that point. A prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, according to a Shigionoth, which means according to a highly emotional poem. Some people say that Shigionoth means that it's a not just emotional, but that it weaves back and forth. It goes from highs to lows back and forth. Yahweh, Lord, I have heard the report about you, just like Job. I heard about you, and I fear. That is a reverent fear. That is not a slavish fear. That is not, oh no, I'm afraid of that God. It's, I reverence this God because he deserves it. I have heard the report about you, and I fear. Oh Yahweh, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. In other words, what he is saying is, Israel has a history with you. They are your people. And I remember the history of Israel. I remember you delivered them out of Egypt. He's going to make reference to that in a moment. I remember that you took them to Mount Sinai and that you gave them your law, that you established them as a people. I remember the whole Red Sea thing. I have heard about that. I have heard all of that through the scriptures. I know what you've done in the past. Do that again. Stir up your power again. Demonstrate that you are God again. Now in verse 3, he's referring back to that Sinai moment. God comes from Taman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. And then he says, Selah, which means pause for a moment and think about that. It also may be a musical designation where there's a little bit of music there in order for people to stop and consider what he is saying. At the very end of this book, he does say that it's for the choir director on the stringed instruments. So this is meant to be a musical portion of the worship of God within the temple. Talked about that last week. God's earlier visitation at Mount Sinai is obviously what Habakkuk is referring to here, because he said God came from Teman and then points out he's the Holy One from Mount Paran. If you go back to Deuteronomy 33:2, you'll read that Moses had said that the Lord's appearance was like a light shining from Seir to Mount Paran. And so he's making reference to, once upon a time, your glory was on the earth so great that it covered a vast area. Do that again. And demonstrate yourself again to your people. Show your power. Revive your work. Revive your power in the midst of these years. In the midst of the years, make it known. Make it known that you are still the powerful, righteous God. But in your wrath, as you're conquering Babylon, show mercy. Remember mercy for Israel. Reestablish your people. Remember how you, God, the Holy One, you came from Teman, and you were the Holy One who was on Mount Paran. Think about that. You're the God whose splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. His radiance is like the sunlight, and his rays flashing from his hand. And there is the hiding of his power, the holding of his power. We couldn't stand, we couldn't live if he were to just unleash his power. Remember when Moses asked to see God's glory, and God said, I'll have to put you in the cleft of a rock and cover you with my hand and let you see just the last parts of my glory as it passes by you. Because if you actually beheld my glory, it would kill you. That's what Habakkuk seems to be getting at here, that there is this radiance to him. There is this flashing rays that come from his hands. And there is that protection, that hiding of his power. And by the way, he's the same God who Isaiah describes as the one who brings about good and evil. So verse 5 says, before him goes pestilence, and plague comes after him. He is the judging God, and he is the one that brings about absolutely everything because he's absolutely sovereign, and that includes the really bad stuff, the plagues, the pestilences, and even the conquering people who are going to come and conquer his people, Israel. He's in charge of all of it. He stood and he surveyed the earth. He looked over the earth and he looked and he startled the nations. Now, in a moment, he's going to talk about what he means by he startled the nations. He's still describing the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. Because in a moment, he's particularly going to refer to Cushan and to Midian, who were nations, who were people groups, who lived on either side of the Red Sea. And they were the ones who beheld the Red Sea parting and Israel going through and the destruction of the Egyptians. And yes, that would startle somebody. He looked and he startled the nations. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. That could mean that he was changing the course of nature, that mountains were moving. But mountains oftentimes are also used as designations of power. Powerful nations are referred to as mountains, especially like in Daniel's prophecies. So he could be saying those powerful nations that think they are unmovable, those perpetual mountains, will ultimately be shattered. They'll be destroyed. And the ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. If you come away with nothing else tonight, come away with that. The ways of God are everlasting. Mountains might move, ancient hills might collapse. But his ways, his determinations, the God who is in his holy temple, he's unchanging, he's everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan under distress, and the tent curtains of the land of Midian were trembling. Yes, because if that people group has a God like that, who can open up the Red Sea and deliver them on dry land, which these people were witness to, you can see why they were frightened. So then, as he was separating the water, whether we're talking about the Red Sea, whether we're talking about the Jordan 40 years later, he did those things. Habakkuk knows those things. He's heard the report about those things. And so we ask the question, did the Lord rage against the rivers? Now that question is asked in such a way that you presuppose the answer is no. What he's saying is, when he parted the water, was he mad at the water? No, he was mad at people. But he was demonstrating his power in the waters. Did the Lord rage against the rivers? Or was your anger against the rivers? Or was your wrath against the sea, against the Red Sea when he opened it up? Was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation? Your bow was made bare. In other words, you took your bow from its sheath. The rods of chastisement, which are probably a reference to the arrows that go with that bow, the rods of chastisement were sworn. Think about that. You cleaved the earth with rivers. Now he's all the way back to the creation in Genesis. He's continuing to say, I've heard about you. I've heard a report about you. This is all the stuff you've done in the past. Just do it again. Show that you are the God who did all that. You separated the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and quaked. The downpour of waters swept by. Now he's talking about Noah. I've heard about that too. You're the one that brought about the flood. And the deep uttered forth its voice, and it lifted high its hands. The sun and moon stood in their place, and they went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. In other words, you put the sun and the moon in the firmament for light by night and light by day, but when it comes to your radiance, they go dark. They're nothing compared to you. In indignation, you marched through the earth. In anger, you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people. For the salvation of your anointed, you struck the head of the house of evil. I think he's talking about the deliverance from Egypt and how he drowned the Egyptian armies that were following after his people Israel. He brought salvation to his people because those were his chosen, his anointed people. But then he struck the head of the evil to lay him open from thigh to neck. Selah, think about it. He destroyed them utterly. You pierced with his own spears the head of his throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exaltation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. He may at that point be talking about the Assyrians. He may be talking about the fact that they did attack all the way down to Jerusalem, and yet God, in one night, wiped out the army, sent them running back home. And so they are ultimately pierced by the very things that they were trying to pierce the Israelites with. They are the ones who scattered Israel. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. You trampled on the sea with your horses and on the surge of many waters. The picture, the image being You're in control of all of your creation. You are riding on your chariot of clouds. You are the one who is sovereignly in charge of all of what happens, whether we're talking the sun or the moon, whether we're talking about the rising up of nations, whether we're talking about the conquering of nations, whether we're talking about the delivering of your people. Everything that is being accomplished in the world and in history is ultimately in God's hand, and that is what Habakkuk seems to be coming to the realization of, because then he says, I heard it all. I heard all that stuff, that report that I heard about you that caused me to fear you. I heard, and my inward parts trembled. I have to say that when it comes to modern concepts of God, modern ideas of the God of the Bible and what he's like, you know, the big marshmallow in the sky, the old man with the beard, the loving grandfather God that so many people... The idea of trembling seems to be missing. If you have a real concept of the real God, he is the sovereign God who is in control of everything, who sends people into outer darkness and eternal flames of torment. He is the one who raises up kings. He is the one who destroys nations. He's the one who formed the world and who will burn it and make it all new. If that's the God you're dealing with, maybe a little trembling would be appropriate. Because if you're not trembling before that God, you still don't understand who he is. But Habakkuk came to understand who that was. And how did he come to understand it? Through the report, through the story, through the history of who God is and what he has done and how he has delivered his people. He was serious enough in his understanding of the story of God that it led him to fear that God, to tremble before that God, and then to remember that that God said that Babylon was coming. So now he has to adjust his thinking, he has to adjust his eschatology, he has to adjust his theology to bring it in league with what God has already said. And so he concludes, all I can do now, knowing that sovereign God has told me what it is he intends to do, my place is just to be quiet and wait for it because it's definitely coming. And I need to be fearful of the God who said that. I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones. And in my place, I tremble because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. And though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. Even in the midst of terror, even in the midst of a lack of food, even in the midst of the whole land falling into famine, being deprived, and ultimately being invaded and taken into bondage in Babylon for 70 years. Despite all that, Habakkuk says, yet I will lift up the name, I will exalt in Yahweh, and I will rejoice in the God of my salvation, even though my circumstances don't look like salvation. Nevertheless, he is the God of my salvation. He has made promises to me, and I will praise his holy name regardless of what happens. Now, by the way, after the description that Habakkuk has just given us, that he has to wait patiently for the people who he knows are definitely coming to invade Jerusalem, coming to destroy his beloved people. Despite the fact that there won't be any food, there won't be any fruit, there won't be any oil, there won't be flocks or milk, there won't be meat to eat, there's going to be nothing, And despite all that, despite those circumstances, he's still going to exalt the Lord and trust God. What are your circumstances? What are you going through that compares to that? Some of us have gone through some pretty tough stuff in this lifetime. And yet, despite the tough circumstances, the call from Habakkuk is to still exalt the name of the Lord, to rejoice in the God of your salvation. Because the Lord God, Adonai Yahweh, he's my strength. It's not my circumstances. It's not even the food. It's not even the land. I'm going to be conquered. But I trust him. He's the one that's going to get me through it. Through the years here at GCA, I have asked the question several times, have you ever gone through a circumstance in your life that you thought you weren't going to make it through? You thought, this one's going to kill me. Have you ever thought that? I certainly have. Several of us in this room have. Usually when I ask that question, I ask for a show of hands, but I won't do that tonight because I know how much you dislike it. And I want you to still like me, and so I will not ask for that. But after my show of hands of how many people have at some point in their life said, I'm not going to make it, this is going to kill me, I then ask, and how many of you lived? And of course, the fact that they're here to say it means they lived through it. Okay, then how? How did you live through it? How did you get through the circumstances of life that you were certain were going to destroy you? Well, it wasn't you. Your attitude was, this is going to kill me. Your attitude was, I might as well die. How did you get through it? Because Yahweh, God, the Lord Almighty, the God of armies, he's the strength when you're out of strength. Even Paul said that, what time I'm weak, then Christ is strong. Because our strength as Christian people doesn't come from us. It doesn't emanate from us. Left to ourselves, we're just balls of dust. But if we have the power of God by his Spirit in us, sustaining us, carrying us, giving us confidence, conforming our mind, and bringing us to faith in God despite our circumstances, then we will get through every circumstance that comes our way. It's just like Paul wrote, there is no temptation taken you, no trial you've gone through, except what is common to man. But God is faithful, who will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape so that you might bear it. It's the same message all the way through. We're just measly humans. But one measly human joined with an almighty sovereign God is a pretty unmovable force. And so that's what Habakkuk comes to. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. And then this beautiful piece of poetry that he closes with. And he has made my feet like hinds' feet to make me walk on my high places. He is looking at the deer who have the ability to walk up the sides of mountains and rocky crags to reach the top. And he says, that's how he's going to make my feet. My feet are going to be able to climb through these very difficult circumstances until I ultimately reach the high place. And if the high place that you reach is the eternal presence with God in his glory, and he's the one who did it all, despite the difficult circumstances and the craggy mountainsides of this lifetime, if you end up there through his strength, through his sovereignty, through his plan, you're not going to have a lot of problem worshiping that God and recognizing that he did it all, and you did none of it. Now, Habakkuk wanted that to be repeated. He wanted it to be said in the temple over and over again. He wanted musical accompaniment to it. He wanted to treat it like one of the Psalms. And that's why he then said, it's for the choir director on stringed instruments. because he wanted that story to be told over and over again. So what have we learned from the book of Habakkuk? Number one, God's ways are not our ways. Sometimes we have to just kind of step back and go, well, okay, you're God. I don't get this. I'm not sure what's happening here. More than once, okay, more than 100, more than 1,000 times, I have gone through stuff in my life, looked up at the sky and said, what is this about? Because stuff happens that I just didn't see coming. And yet he sustained me through it. Because he's the God who can do whatever he wants, and therefore our job is to learn to just say, yes, sir. Whatever it is you're doing with me, I belong to you, your sovereign God. Whatever the circumstances, I have faith in you, I trust you. And what we know from chapter 2 is God is righteous, God is holy, and he will always punish sin, and he is in his holy temple, where holiness and righteousness dwells, and that's why he is not going to leave this creation in the fallen state that it is currently in. The end of the story is that his righteousness is going to cover the earth the same way that the waters cover the earth. The same way, by the way, that Jesus in the Lord's Prayer said to pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth the way it is in heaven. There is a glorious day coming. There is a much better day than today coming. But we have to pass through these tough days first to get to the glorious days, and we're only going to be able to do that by his strength. And that's a story that needs to be told over and over again. Next week is Ask Me Anything week. I announced on Sunday that after we close the book of Habakkuk, we'd have another Ask Me Anything Wednesday because they've been pretty popular in the past. They work pretty well. So people have actually asked me, when are you going to do that again? So next Wednesday, come with your questions, and your questions can be about anything. My egg salad recipe, you can ask me about GCA, how we got where we are today. You can ask me theological questions. And if you ask me something, it's like stump the band. If you ask me something I don't know, I'll tell you I don't know it. But there are smart people in the room who probably can tell you. So spread the word. Next week, Ask Me Anything Wednesday.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. For books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.